This podcast is an unedited excerpt from a live MCLE webcast. See the episode notes for details about the speakers and links to the program's full video and audio recording. Get access to everything MCLE offers for one low subscription fee with the MCLE Online Pass. Learn more at www.mcle.org/onlinepass. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or by its speakers. For full terms and conditions, see MCLE's website.
Thanks to, I'm Jamie Klass. I'm a partner at Foley & Lardner in Boston. And I want to thank MCLE for hosting the panel today on commercial loans. And I want to thank Matt Doering, Sean Gilligan, and Felisa Sanchez for joining us here today to go over the materials that we're going to cover on commercial loans. So we have a big agenda today to cover. Do you see my screen? You do. Okay, great. So we have quite a long agenda to cover today, and we're going to cover some high-level points, and we'll also cover some more technical and nitty-gritty points. And I'm looking forward to hearing what the other panelists have to teach us today. So to start off with, we'll start a little bit high level, talking about structuring a deal, which it's not only the deal terms, but who is involved in the transaction, what is a loan going to be used for, and where in the capital structure will a loan fit in are a few kind of introductory questions to look at when figuring out and structuring a commercial loan transaction. So where does a commercial loan fit in a borrower's typical capital structure? Frequently, a commercial loan is a senior loan, often senior secured, but there can be a junior piece, whether it's junior debt or some kind of an equity type or mezz kicker involved. And it's just important to know where in the capital structure does the loan fit, as well as are there other sources of capital? For example, will other debt be needed, or is this commercial loan all that is needed for a particular borrower? That's an important thing to know in structuring your loan. If the capital structure is more complicated, there will of course be more interested parties involved. Or to be considered in structuring a loan. Another thing when working on a commercial loan is to figure out whose perspective you're looking it at. So lenders and borrowers really look at it differently. And I'd be interested to know from my fellow panelists how they approach things differently when they're representing a borrower versus a lender in a loan. There's just definitely different priorities. A lot of times lenders and borrowers aligned, everyone wants to, things going well, pay back the loan, etc. But lenders have a particular concern to make sure that they're going to be paid back and that they're going to be well protected in a bankruptcy. And that's just not the same level of concern for a borrower. And on the flip side, a borrower will often want to be able to have a great deal of flexibility in operating its business and entering into other transactions, because it will want to take advantage of opportunities as they arrive, or they want to protect against problems. They don't, if something unforeseen happens, of course, a borrower doesn't want that to create a default, but a lender may look at it like that's a time where a lender may want to intervene and have a so-called seat at the table. So the parties really do look at the transaction quite a bit differently when structuring and negotiating a loan. Felisa, do you have how this works, please?
You asked for some perspectives, and so I did just want to weigh in, and I think you have some good items listed on the slide, but sort of as an overarching viewpoint, you know, when you're documenting the deal, when you're negotiating the term sheet, everyone, you know, particularly the borrower, thinks things are going to go as planned. There's a very rosy outlook for what the future holds. This is their plan and they're going to execute on it, and they're assuming that things are going to go perfectly and that there's not going to be anything out of left field. Lenders are, as you mentioned, a little more conservative. They're going to look at it and ask more questions, try to think about worst case scenarios, but a lot of times they do get comfortable just because, you know, people want to get the deal done. One of the things I think we've seen in the last few years is there's a lot of things that can happen. I mean, a few years ago, no one would have guessed that a global pandemic would basically shut down the global economy. You wouldn't see the supply chain issues that a lot of companies are struggling with right now. There's just a lot of things that people probably didn't plan for when they were documenting their loans a few years ago. And that's when both parties start to, you know, go back and look at their documentation and really start questioning, you know, am I fully protected? If you're a lender, am I fully protected to the extent I need to be protected in this situation? Did I envision this happening? And as a borrower, you're wanting to make sure that you have flexibility and capital access so that you can keep your business going. And so a lot of times you'll see the parties coming back to the table and negotiating either amendments or, you know, just talking to each other at that point. But, you know, one thing I would say is I think when you're representing either side as counsel, you do need to, you know, think critically about what, you know, what are potential risks for your client down the road that maybe they're not thinking about. And you do want to walk them through that. I think that's fine. I don't know if anyone has anything else to add from general perspective, but.
Matt or Sean?
Jamie, the one thing, and Felisa, thank you. The one thing I'll add from just a general perspective, and I'm not sure how detailed we're going to talk about this later on, is really taking a critical eye from the borrower's perspective on the financial covenants. In part because, you know, for those of us that represent lenders, there are, for lack of a better word, some off-the-shelf definitions, some form documents as to, you know, how a fixed charge coverage ratio might be measured or a debt service coverage ratio. And they often get plugged into term sheets. And depending upon the sophistication of the chief financial officer of the borrower, you know, are basically accepted wholesale. And so one of the things that I'm very, you know, when I'm representing a borrower, I have very detailed conversations with the CFO as to, you know, run through these, like literally parse through these elements of the various ratios that are being put in place here, and actually go through the borrowing base now to make sure it works. Because, you know, obviously when we represent borrowers, one of the things we focus on are the triggers where the lender gets to exercise remedies. And without doing sort of the detailed forensic analysis of the covenants up front, it's a very easy place to get, you know, to fall into a trap later at a point in time where the borrower has a lot less leverage than it does at inception.
Exactly. Sean?
On the comments by Felisa and by Matt, again, we have to understand sort of best case, worst case, and middle case scenario. And a lot of our clients, because we represent a lot of emerging growth companies, sometimes it's the first time that the CFO has ever closed a commercial loan transaction. So there's a lot of education going on there, but I warn every single one of them that the possibility that there's going to be a hiccup sometimes during the term of the loan is extraordinarily high. Hopefully the hiccup is not that great, but they do happen and you have to be prepared for it. And then also make sure, as Matt pointed out, make sure that everyone understands the financial covenants, right? The last thing you want to do is trip a financial covenant, because then all of a sudden red flags go up within the lender, and then you're on a target list and it's a much different relationship. And my job as an attorney is to forewarn the client and make sure that we're not sort of setting ourselves up for an earlier intermediate failure.
Yeah, exactly. And financial covenants are a very important part, and we can get into it a little bit later in more detail, but it does, it's an overlap between accounting and legal and business disciplines to come up with these financial covenants. And I agree, having a model that runs through it is super important. Thanks. Going back to just some fundamentals of commercial loans, which you're going to cover. So the key business terms need to get determined. And one of them is, what is the loan going to be used for? And accordingly, what are the conditions to draw? That's a high level point, because loans that are used for different things can be structured in different ways. Similarly, whether a loan is a term loan made once or a few times but paid back at a certain time, certain date, versus a revolving loan, which is advanced, repaid, and re-advanced, sometimes based on a borrowing base formula. People have heard the phrase formula line, meaning there's a formula supporting the borrowing base, some kind of a 85% of accounts receivable or based on inventory or various things, versus non-formula. It's just a revolver that's available for a certain amount over a period of time that can be borrowed and repaid. The term sheet will, and I think we have a section here on term sheets, but these pricing terms will need to get arrived at in the term sheet. Pricing meaning interest and fees, and whether there's any other consideration given, like a warrant, et cetera. And then the repayment terms and maturity will also need to get decided. This slide omits specifically who are the obligors. It falls under the category of collateral and guarantees, meaning what is the credit support that's going to be provided for a loan? What obligors other than a particular borrower will be responsible and provide its credit for the loan? That will be a deal term that needs to get decided. Early repayment, due on demand notes, basically the lender can just demand early payment at any time. In my personal practice, I don't see that very often. When I see it, it's a red flag. We want to make sure that people who are entering into a demand note understand that. There's can be reasons why it can be demanded, or from a lender's perspective, they need, you know, it can be needed to be structured as a demand, but just it's a unique type of a loan, which although it can have events of default listed and typically do, you don't need a default in order for payment to be accelerated. Matt, do you have something to add?
Yeah, just to add to that, because demand notes, though they sound simple, can really cause a host of problems, especially if, you know, they're poorly documented and there are things like events of default, which are wholly inconsistent with the very idea of what a demand, demand nature of a note. But one thing that I find will often trick people is if there are two credit extensions under the same loan agreement. So perhaps there is a revolving line of credit that's demand, and then the bank has also offered a five-year term loan, which is not demand. And that's all fine, but where I see a lot of people fall into a trap is if those facilities are cross-defaulted and cross-accelerated.
Yeah.
So what happens is that if you have a demand loan I'm sorry, if you have a term loan that's cross-accelerated with a demand, then the accounting effect is that that is no longer long-term debt. So even though it's structured as a five-term loan, because it is cross-accelerated to a demand loan under accounting rules, that goes from long-term debt, you know, matures past 12 months to short-term debt. So that could have, you know, a ripple effect on, you know, financial calculations and reporting that none of the parties intended to, just because of a simple clause in a loan agreement. So just a little tip for the wary.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have due on demand, look at it a little bit more carefully and think it through. And then another point that would need to get resolved in the term sheet is whether there's financial covenants, or it's so-called covenant light. I wanted to circle back to the use of funds because I think that what the loan is used for is an important factor in figuring out what the rest of the loan needs to say and for example, the representations and warranties, the meaning of how important those are. So types of loans include using money for working capital, using money for an acquisition specifically, or a loan for project development and finance. Loan proceeds can also just be used for a short term to bridge a loan for a short-term liquidity need, or there can be margin loans. Margin loans means a loan that's secured by margin stock, meaning publicly traded securities. And when you get into margin loans, there's the Federal Reserve rules, and because there's rules against borrowing too much against public securities. So that's a regulated type of loan. And the funding conditions correlate to the type of loan. But what will always tie those, pretty much in all cases, for a funding condition are two things. No default can have occurred when you do the drawdown, and the reps and warranties must be true at that time. One particular type of a loan is an acquisition loan. And a lot of loans can be used for acquisitions if it's permitted under the loan agreement. But an acquisition loan where it's a loan specifically to pay the purchase price for an acquisition. So it would be a loan available to a buyer in an acquisition to purchase a seller or assets of a seller or to fund a merger or something. And an issue is if the buyers plan to use its credit agreement to buy assets or buy another company, the question is, will the money be available? Even if it's allowed to buy it, will the money actually be available from the funding source? Because we just spoke about there can't be a default and all the reps have to be true at that time. So there's a risk that due to the buyer's condition or something that happens to the buyer, that the buyer won't have the money available to purchase the target. And that can be a worry for a target that's selling, and it can be a competitive disadvantage if it's a competitive bidding situation, if the buyer has a lot of conditions to paying the purchase price. So there is a type of a loan, which is called a certain funds financing, which has more tailored and limited funding conditions so that the buyer, also a borrower, will have more certainty that it will have the money available to pay for the acquisition. And therefore, the target has more confidence in the buyer's ability to pay. So the task would be aligning the acquisition agreement with the financing agreement. And there's conventional provisions to add to both the purchase agreement and the loan agreement if that type of a loan is going to be made available. And may I add, paid for, because it's not free for the bank to agree to limit its conditions to such a few number of conditions. Matt?
Yeah, and interrupt me, Jamie. I don't want to jump ahead and cover something that you may be covering in the future, but you know, the other sort of term of art of this are the sun guard provisions. And it's essentially, you know, at the commitment level, lender, when the bank makes the commitment to lend, you know, in a normal deal, there'll be a whole host of conditions precedent before they are agreed to put the first funds out the door. Well, what a lot of with some sophisticated, you know, buyers and sellers have come up with are, you know, reducing the number of conditions, as Jamie mentioned, to a handful. And there are things along the lines of, you know, any specific outcome of the purchase agreement, any solvency requirements, but not the full litany of conditions precedent that you would see in a financing that did involve funds certain. And I just say that because, you know, one of the purposes of this very, very broad topic seminar is to flag some issues that you may come across that may need a little further research, further guidance. And if you're representing a lender that has not done many of these fund certain deals, it'll be a bit of a shock to the system because you are streamlining their commitment to only a certain number of items that are much less than what they're used to. So it may be an opportunity for you to educate your client. And one of the purposes again of this seminar is to flag when those issues might arise for you.
Right, exactly. Thank you, Matt. I'm going to skip over this. This just says what a loan agreement, what will be in a loan agreement. So I want to focus for a couple of minutes on negative covenants and then we'll get into the financial covenants. So a key part of the loan agreement will be negative covenants. The borrower cannot do, or the obligors cannot do certain things. One of the main ones is there can't be debt, indebtedness. And so you question, what is the definition of indebtedness? And it's not only debt for borrowed money, it would be, deferred purchase price of property and potentially contingent obligations. So there's other type of indebtedness other than just debt for borrowed money. And especially when you're dealing with borrowers who are potentially having some financial difficulties, but for any borrower really, deferred purchase price of property can mean paying your vendors over a period of time, technically. So potentially you could be in default for paying your trade debt late, which may make sense. Maybe that is what the lender is thinking about because they don't want people not paying their bills for a long period of time because it does turn into debt. But frequently there's a carve out for ordinary course trade debt. And then you can get into, but only if the debt is less than only if the trade has been unpaid for 90 days or something along those lines. But that is, you know, there's a whole host of carve outs for these debt and lien covenants, including the trade debt carve out. I wanted to just touch on the concept of ring fencing, which is typically used where if there's more than one obligor, there's a debtor and either guarantors or multiple borrowers, those entities all have given their credit and often liens to the lender. And so transferring, making intercompany investments or loans amongst those co-obligors is typically acceptable to the lender because those entities have provided their credit already to the lender. So that's okay. But if you have entities outside of the so-called ring fence, then there is a concern by lenders to try to limit that because the lenders would have no claim against those non obligors. And this comes up a lot of time with foreign subsidy, you know, and U.S. entities, U.S. borrowers having foreign subsidiaries and then wanting to use assets to fund the operations of the subsidiaries. That could be an investment that may not be allowed because it's a non-obligor. So those are things that need to get worked out. There are solutions. There's trying to limit the amount that goes out or limit the amount at least sitting in a bank out overseas, et cetera. But there are ways to address those points. And there's also, you know, a litany of negative covenants, including no mergers or changes of control. Sometimes the change of control is a default. Sometimes it's a negative covenant. It doesn't really matter which way it is. For a typical loan, it means the loan will become due if there's a change of control. And then you decide what is the change of control and whether there's any allowable changes that wouldn't trigger that. And then negative pledge and double negative pledge. A negative pledge is the borrower will not give collateral to a third party. But a double negative pledge is the borrower will not agree with a third party not to give collateral. And the reason is, for example, if a borrower borrows from a lender and doesn't give a lien on its, let's say, real estate and IP, because it's hard to perfect those, for example. So there's some collateral that's unperfected, or there's no lien on it, it's unsecured. The lender doesn't want the borrower agreeing with someone else that they won't allow the lender to get a lien on that real estate and IP later. So that's the basic bottom line, because in case things don't go as planned or for whatever reason, the lender may want that additional collateral later. So that's kind of the source of this double negative pledge that is usually included in loan agreements. We have a couple of minutes to talk about financial covenants, and I know that they're very important because they, are supposed to be a measure for the financial health and well-being and, protection for the lender to make sure that the borrower is performing as it needs to and is going to be able to pay back the loan. So there's a couple of general types of covenants. There's permissive covenants. If certain covenants are met, then such and such can occur. For example, dividends. If certain covenants are met, then dividends can be paid. Versus maintenance covenants, which these ratios must be maintained. And if they don't, if they're not maintained, then a default occurs and an acceleration can occur. When we say that a required ratio must be maintained, it doesn't necessarily, there's usually a testing period. So some covenants are hard to measure, to maintain all the time or to know if you're maintaining it all the time in the middle of a month. If, for example, if it's tied to EBITDA, if it's tied to where your earnings are, you need to calculate that. So you may not know that mid-month. Whereas other covenants, you're going to know, for example, if there's a liquidity covenant or something, you're going to know if that number changes. But the point being, maintenance covenants are usually tested at particular times, monthly, quarterly, or sometimes all the time. It's just important to know that when these covenants are tested. One of the most important definitions in financial covenants is EBITDA. And EBITDA is the most basic earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, meaning you take consolidated net income and you add back, that's why before, you add back interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So that is the most basic definition of EBITDA. People can negotiate additional add backs to EBITDA because to try to better approximate how much, how the business is doing and what the general cash amount would be for generated by the borrower. So some of the add backs that can be added are, so non-cash items, adding back those non-cash items, for example, either specifically stock compensation or generally non-cash items. And if you're going to add back general non-cash items, you're going to need to reduce EBITDA by non-cash gains. There's also often cash charges can be added back. For example, if there's you have to spend, if the borrower needs to spend cash for discontinued operations or for transaction costs or other things that are kind of one-time things and shouldn't be used generally to measure the health, then a lender may say, okay, this transaction cost a certain amount of money. You can add that back to your EBITDA because that's not a general measure of your health. So that's where some of these cash add backs can come in. And then there's, for acquisitions, there can often be an add back for, well, I don't know about often, depending on the situation, you may be able to arrive on an add back for synergies or cost savings due to acquisitions, because if an acquisition occurs, it's going to end up being potentially cheaper to run the combined business. And that's a synergy and a cost saving that may be agreed to be added back to EBITDA. And then I wanted to touch briefly on pro forma EBITDA, because EBITDA is, you know, at its basic, it's going to be a historical measurement. You're going to come to March 31st, you're going to prepare your calculations, you're going to measure your EBITDA for the period ending March 31st. Pro forma comes on in, because let's say a company's going to do an acquisition in the middle after March 31st, let's say it's June 23rd, and an acquisition is closing, and if there's a covenant saying you have to measure your EBITDA or your leverage ratio, which uses EBITDA, if you have to measure that pro forma for the acquisition, that means you take your last historical financials that were published March 31st, and you pro forma in the fact of the acquisition. So at a simple way, money was spent to pay for the acquisition, and you're going to, you can acquire the EBITDA of, let's say there was a audited financials for your target, you can maybe count that EBITDA too as pro forma for the past year. So it's not only the borrowers, but it's the target's EBITDA that you kind of assume is combined as of March 31st. So that's the concept of the pro forma treatment of EBITDA. And it's important because a lot of loan agreements will allow acquisitions to occur if there's pro forma compliance, at a minimum, pro forma compliance with the financial covenants. Sometimes there could be a step up, so-called leverage covenant holiday, covenant holiday, they call it, meaning you have a step up. You can have a little higher leverage when you do your acquisition, but you still need to do the pro forma treatment, whether it's the existing covenant or there's a step up due to the leverage holiday. So these are just some examples of how you can draft the pro forma. It can get complicated. It can be more simple, but some of the key financial covenants are going to be based on EBITDA, like we just spoke about, interest coverage, debt service coverage, and fixed charge coverage. And for the leverage ratios, these, we can go back to the question of debt. What debt is being compared to EBITDA for your leverage ratio? Some variations are total debt, just indebtedness, total funded debt, really debt for borrowed money, but potentially wouldn't include like letters of credit or something which would be a contingent obligation, but it's not actually funded. You can also look at senior debt or net debt, which is you take debt and you net out a certain amount of cash. So those are some of the variations on leverage ratios. And capital expenditures is another common one where there's often a rollover. If all capital expenditures aren't expended by a particular day, there could be a rollover. So I'd like to pause there. I'm almost done with the financial covenants, but does anyone on the panel have a question or a comment on how to approach this? Sean? I mean, sorry, Matt?
You can call me Sean, Jimmy. That's fine. just one sort of additional add-on is that, a lot of the financial covenants, especially the ones that are tied to EBITDA, are measured on a rolling 12-month or rolling four-quarter period. So in addition to the pro forma EBITDA discussion, as you mentioned during acquisition, another way that borrowers and lenders will handle it is essentially allow EBITDA to build over the first four quarters following the extension of credit. So, essentially with rough numbers, so you would take the first quarter following the extension of credit, and for that test period, you would multiply it by four. And conversely, after two quarters, you'd multiply that by two. And then after you get the four quarters, you have the full rolling 12-month or four-quarter look back. But you'll frequently see in the documents to negotiate this sort of build-up period, especially if the financing was done for a particular acquisition.
Right. And I think also if they're not audited previously, it's one thing to rely to pro forma in audited financials for the past 12 months. But unaudited is, I think what you're suggesting is a really good solution for that scenario. Well, we zipped through that. Any particular questions that came up, Felisa, on the web about this?
No, not yet.
Okay, great. I think, so that's high level on loan agreements, key terms, and then trying to situate people in the financial covenants and how important they are to look at carefully and work with borrowers and lenders to get right. And now I think we're going to turn to Felisa, who's going to help us figure out what are the key points in getting a deal done once we have the terms. Because a lot of times when the business people have the terms agreed, the next thing they do is call their lawyer and then say, why isn't it done yet? So, that's why we call Felisa sometimes and say, we have our deal. Now, please help us get it done. So I turn it over to you, Felisa.
Thanks, Jamie. Thank you.